Welcome to the NMK podcast. NMK is a learning and business information hub for companies and individuals working in UK digital media and runs a year-round programme of courses, conferences and events. This was recorded at NMK's Content 2.0 conference on the 6th of June 2006. The session is a scene setter talk by Matt Locke of BBC New Media titled Folksonomies, What Are They Good For?
I've got two rules whenever I do presentations like this. One is don't be in the session after lunch, because everyone kind of sleeps off the great food they've had. And the second one is never talk after Bradley Horowitz, because he's just too damn good. I'm going to cover a little bit of the same ground of Bradley, but I'm going to take it from slightly a different angle. I'm also doing this not really from the perspective of someone that works from the BBC, but I'm going to talk a lot about what we're doing. But this is very much not me speaking officially as someone from the Beeb, and just kind of ranting about stuff that I think is interesting. Seeing as this was about Content 2.0, I thought what I'd do is rather than talk in a language that all of us speak, I'll try and talk in the language that I tend to speak when I'm at work. So this presentation's written vaguely in the style of a kind of imaginary Socratic dialogue between myself and somebody who doesn't get this stuff. Because what I want to do is try and explain the things that really stick in the maw of people who kind of understand that the world that they know is changing and they've got to somehow get into it, but they don't quite know how they're going to do it. So this is going to be a slightly academic, slightly hand-wavy, very kind of macro talk. And what I'm going to do is try and put folksonomy as just one aspect of these kind of transformations we're talking about today, and try and explain it as I would explain it to a kind of an anonymous BBC executive. Kind of imagine someone looking a bit like that guy in the middle there in the Ermine. And I'm going to try and explain where this has come from and a bit of the kind of history around it, what makes it kind of interesting, and what potentially are the barriers to a large media organisation taking advantage of these kinds of things. I'm going to make a couple of completely spurious assumptions that I expect to be shot down if we get any time for Q&A, or I might just expand the talk just long enough so I don't get any Q&A, and I can walk away assuming that you all agree with me. So, first thing is, this is still relatively new. We talked a lot about the history of some of these things. I'll be coming back to this a bit. But Google Trends think that folksonomy has only really appeared on the scene in late 2005, but I think it's lying somewhat. I want to go back a bit further, and I want to talk about folksonomy as part of a much broader issue around classification. This is a fantastic book, which if you're really interested in this, I guarantee you will find a lot of interesting things in. By Bowker and Starr, called Classification and Its Consequences. And it was written in 1999, but it really, by using very anecdotal case studies of how classifications have impacted on people, we're talking a lot about people today, impacted on people's lives, on people's kind of social lives, their communities, it gives us a lot of valuable tools outside of purely a digital conversation around what tagging is as a technology. I'm not going to talk a lot about technology at all in this talk. I want to really talk about people and about the kind of motivations of people, and in particular, the differences around people. I think one of the things today is people have talked about consumers revolting, and they've talked about people as a block, as if we all want to do the same things, and people's motivations are all entirely similar. I'm going to suggest that actually they're quite radically different, and that what we need to understand in building these tools is to understand more granularly what we mean when we talk about users, consumers, prosumers, pro-ams, people formerly called audience, whatever. So anyway, this book is a really good example of some historical analysis of how classification and communities interact. And I'm going to pick one particular thing that they talk about in this book. They talk about a case study of a group of nurses who were writing a taxonomy about their work. At that point in time in the States, in the administration of hospitals, nurses' work was bundled into the cost of the room. So when they were kind of budgeting for how much it was costing to manage patients, all the work that nurses did was just kind of lodged into the cost of the room. And that work wasn't visible. And a lot of the stuff that Bowker and Starr are writing about is how classifications make things visible or invisible and the political and social implications of that. This bunch of nurses got together and they started writing a classification about their work, and it included lots and lots of things which were previously taken for granted by the hospitals, and it gave the nurses a lot of power. It was a kind of emerging folksonomy in a way of these nurses talking about their work and adopting a structure that enabled them to communicate that to people who were managing them, who were paying their wages, and who were organising their lives. But they used this example of the nurses' vocabulary database to talk about three things which are constantly in tension in any form of classification. And those three things are, one, comparability. Comparability is like the kind of stated goal of most classification systems. It's in a way the kind of thing that Tim Berners-Lee talks about in the semantic web, the ability to transfer terms from context to context and then still to have some kind of meaning. So a tree is a tree is a tree, whether it's a red tree or a green tree. Comparability is normally what's the kind of achievable things that most taxonomists, most taxonomists set out to do. Control is really the kind of reality of any kind of classification. And that's not control in a kind of really binary opposition sense. Control, I think, is a kind of continuum within classifications. As soon as you have any form of classification over any community or any group of resources, you're implying some kind of control over that. No matter who's writing it, how dynamic it is, there is always, at any kind of point in the use of that classification structure, some kind of control at stake. And comparability and control are always in tension. If you have an awful lot of control, for example, in government tax forms and things like that, you can get an incredible amount of comparability, but you make a lot of things invisible. And that brings us to the last thing, which is intention, which is really about visibility. Whenever you have classification systems that are used in any kinds of transaction, the notion of visibility is where the politics lie. So if comparability is a kind of stated goal, and control is a reality, visibility is a kind of fantasy of classifications. It's what every classification system sets out to try and really do, to make things which previously were invisible visible. Their ability to succeed in that is really what this kind of tripartite tension organises. And visibility, of course, is what folksonomies have really excelled at. They've made the participation in classification, the participation in describing what you do and what your relationship is, both with resources and with other members of your community, open to everyone, effectively. They've lowered the barrier of entry to forming classifications quite radically, and that's hugely foregrounded visibility in folksonomies as a classification. But it's had other effects. As a result of that, some of those other tensions, comparability and control, have become less important, and that has huge effects on the way in which they're used and the situations in which they're used. So, for example, this is my identical twin brother. He works at AOL. I know there's some people from AOL here. A picture of him I've got up as... I won't go into this too much, but because of the way that Flickr's organised, it means we can have fun and we can play with this. You know, this isn't something that my brother's ever going to use as a recommendation. It's a picture I took of him. I think he looks a little bit like David Cameron, a little bit like Ray Winston, and I think it'd be quite funny if somebody was searching for those terms and they found his picture. So, and it also drives him absolutely nuts when I say that. So basically what I'm hoping to do is to raise the interestingness, and maybe actually this is something you can help me with. Go find this picture, link to it in your blogs. I want to try and get him right. At the moment, he looks more like David Cameron or Ray Winston. It depends on how fat he is at any one point in time. And I really want him to try and rise up the interestingness stake. So anyway, so basically what I'm saying is, you know, these folksonomies foreground a kind of clay. Because of the barriers to entry are so low, they afford all types of behaviours which you would not normally see in classification. And I think clay is by far the most important one of those. I'll go into some of the others later on. So this is my first completely spurious assumption. That because of this, because they're foregrounded visibility so much, and it's such an integral part of what they do, folksonomies are only useful when there is nothing at stake. Now, I use that word only, not in a kind of pejorative sense, because I think that actually the areas in which nothing is at stake are huge and legion, and some of the most interesting areas. It is the world of social media. What I'm saying is that folksonomies aren't very useful in environments where there are very, very hard transactions to get done. eBay would not use folksonomies, perhaps, as a form of reputation management in eBay, because there simply aren't those factors of comparability and control to the level that you would expect them to have. However, there are huge domains of information where we can categorise using folksonomies, where nothing being at stake is part of our expectations of them. And that generally is this area of social media that we're here talking about today. It's my pictures, my websites, my TV viewing habits, my music preferences, my family, my community. These are gigantic spaces. And these are the spaces in which folksonomies really excel. But I still think that tension is going to be there. And part of the problem, speaking to my imaginary BBC executive, is how the interface between environments where there is nothing at stake, it's all about play, it's all about fun, it's all about networks and more and more and more, how they interact with environments where there are scarcities, scarcities of attention, scarcities of economics, all of those kinds of things. We don't quite know where those edges are yet to these boundaries, and that's part of the things that we're trying to sort out in companies like Yahoo, Google, BBC, etc. The second question that the imaginary BBC executive would ask me is, well, you know, what motivates people to tag? You know, why do people do this? Is it just a thing that geeks do because they love typing in data? I do think there are kind of a couple of categories of people that will be online in the next kind of 10 to 15 years. Most of us that are online now are kind of what Bruce Sterling calls data wranglers. You know, we just love wrangling data. We just love kind of linking things together, putting our profiles out there, kind of fishing with these great lines of data to see what kind of value we can bring back in our net. I don't know how well that kind of pursuit carries out into a wider population. I think it's one of the things we're going to find over the next 5 years as we go from 50, 60% online and as more and more people put their lives online. I don't know whether that's a characteristic of the first couple of stages of early adopters, whether it's something that's going to be widely held by audiences as they grow up in these worlds. But at the moment, the motivation to tag purely for the kind of functionality of it and because the ability is there doesn't seem to be enough. However, people have been tagging in various forms for years. Bradley mentioned that, you know, they've been involved in kind of social media for ages doing things like this. You know, it actually goes way back before then. I do think the ability to tag your stuff goes right back through the kind of scrapbooking of the 19th century. So this is a kind of photo book from the early 20s, and, you know, these are tags. That's a tag. That's a tag. And interestingly, and I think this is a potential future area, these are tags as well, these kind of physical objects that represent a moment in time. And we're starting to see our online social lives have some of these kinds of functionalities, but there are huge areas as well where we can start to link where... Link objects from other environments into part of our story. I kind of love the idea of this kind of terrible web, the idea that you can kind of rip bits from your different social lives online and put them together in these kind of scrapbooks and then rip them apart. You know, I'd love to be able to do what this person's done, of, you know, like taking tickets and things from events and building them into your lives. At the moment, that's not that easy. And I think some of what Mark was talking about this morning in terms of having open standards to enable people to shift information about their relationships and lives is critical to that. But I'd love to have a kind of, you know, terrible web where, you know, there were dotted lines around everything. So Flickr, I think, is brilliant in that. You know, the Flickr badge is a perfect example of this kind of terrible web, but I think we're actually a long way from that yet. I'm nicking some of Bradley's team's work here. There's a fantastic document that was part of a presentation at the WWW 2006 conference in Edinburgh. I didn't see it, but I've seen this online. And I think that there's a document they've written about motivations and structures for tagging systems that you should all go and read. The URL's there, and I think it's simply the best vocabulary, the kind of best attempt to try and describe the vocabulary around how tagging systems can be structured and how users are going to be motivated to use them. I think it's the best one that's out there at the moment. And I'm going to use two things from this presentation as part of my imaginary conversation with a BBC boss. The first is this very, very basic description of why people are motivated to tag. Organizational and social. That's pretty straightforward. We do filing and we do kind of scrapbooking. They're the two things that we love doing with our stuff. They actually go a bit further and describe six motivations to tag. And I think the important thing about these is the particular services that you build using folk taxonomies and tagging systems are very, very likely to actually be very, very finely located in these kind of values. So in other words, people will want certain types of tagging contexts to do these individual things. I don't think tagging is something which can exist in the abstract. It exists in a very contextual space and exists as something which has to be very, very, very close to a perceived value to the user. And I'll come back to that in a second. The first one, obviously, is future retrieval. That's what Delicious and other things are around. This one is perhaps what I described as maybe the kind of slightly geekier thing that people are doing now. Tagging for kind of the idea of social contribution, what, you know, kind of Jocko Benckler calls collaborative-based peer production. And I do think that's a motivation for some people, but I don't know how many people are motivated purely by that. We do a lot of things at the BBC, like Springwatch, where we ask people to kind of give us information about their gardens as part of a big, broader project, and we occasionally have these big call-to-arms type projects. And we do get an incredible amount of people, I mean, huge numbers of people contributing. But I don't know, you know, how far that goes. I don't know what the scale of people's motivation to do that is. And I think, you know, increasingly they're around very, very particular editorial hooks, like People's War and other projects like that. This is a kind of ego one, attracting attention, making sure that, you know, your kind of your posts, your stuff is out there and is part of the system. I think, you know, this is something which we see in any kind of social network. Playing competition, this is a bit like what I just asked you to do in my brother's picture, slightly gaming the system. I think this is probably one of the most important motivations in folksonomies. If there is nothing at stake, if there's not a particular value, okay, you will tag for future retrieval, but I think playing competition is potentially, and we saw it with the ESP game, potentially a really, really, really interesting and fruitful way of designing tagging systems. Self-presentation, this is subtly different from attracting attention. It's more about being overt in constructing your identity by the way that you tag objects, by the way that you do things. Saying you are a Spurs fan, saying that you are, as I am, saying that, you know, you live in a certain place, saying that you have certain kinds of tastes. They are all quite overt statements about your identity, which aren't necessarily about attracting attention. They're not necessarily about being top of the pile. It's just about using these kind of forms as a way of actually describing who you are. And then finally, opinion expression. This is more like taste profiling in tagging. And I don't think we're seeing an awful lot of this yet. In their paper, they describe the elitist tag in kind of Yahoo's podcasts as something which is occasionally used pejoratively to kind of give an expression of opinion around the quality of a product. I think this, again, is going to become increasingly important in tagging systems, the way people are giving more value-based judgments rather than just purely factual-based judgments within tags. We did some of our own analysis with Tom Coates before he left for Yahoo with working with Flickr. And something like a quarter of their tags were basically in that first category, or maybe the second category. About a quarter of the tags were basically places and names. Just like that scrapbook, it was, you know, kind of like my dad in London, stuff like that. So I think there are huge areas down here to encourage activity in tagging in some of these other areas where different value models and different kind of relationships will build up. But underneath all of this has been said quite a few times today. The key to designing all of these kind of social systems is that you have to build them for a very selfish individual motive. And again, I don't use the word selfish and individual in a pejorative sense. But basically, people are never really going to be motivated to use these kind of networks unless there is a specific value add back to them. Flickr is just the best way to upload and share your pictures. It's just an amazingly good service. And as a result, people use tags as part of that. But they're not just going to tag it for the sake of it. I'll kind of come back to that in a second, because it's one of the things that we're thinking really hard about at the BBC. You know, what are those kind of selfish individual motives around our content? How can we kind of understand what they are in the users? How can we build systems that kind of exploit them? How can we not exploit them, you know, in a commercial sense, but exploit that, the network effect of those selfish individual motives? Because of all of this, there's a rather important consequence for content owners like the BBC rather than a kind of network service providers like Yahoo. And that is, I think, the most successful taxonomy services are content agnostic. Flickr doesn't actually care what you're taking pictures of as long as it's not pornographic. YouTube doesn't really care what you're putting out videos of as long as it's not pornographic. Delicious doesn't really care what kind of websites you're indexing. The BBC really, really cares to know what you're watching. You know, that's our business. And I think this is the biggest problem for any kind of major content business working in this space, is you've just got to understand that you can't just build something for your stuff. Because actually, people's motivations to use this is about their stuff. It's absolutely about them controlling their own content, their own user-generated content, the content of yours that they're interested in. But the point is, the service itself has to be content agnostic. It can't just be for one type of content whatsoever. And in actual fact, I go so far as to say all social media services, full stop, are content agnostic. Now, this is a kind of classic, puts us as a BBC in the kind of space that Clayton Christensen describes in The Innovator's Dilemma. You know, we are the incumbent being disintermediated massively. And this is a big problem for us. You know, how can we design and deliver services which are about more than just our content? You know, there are so many rights issues and kind of fair trading issues and market issues and stuff like that. But I do believe, you know, and this, as I say, is my opinion, I want to kind of make that quite clear, that content agnosticness is absolutely critical to all of these kinds of social media services. An example of that, typing in BBC into YouTube, the first three results we get back are the Banco, an advert for the Banco Brasilia Comerciale, can't quite remember what it is, basically a Brazilian commercial bank. Then a rather sweet and quite cheesy video for a group who call themselves BBC, and probably stands for something, Billionaires Boy Club or something, ripping off the rap acts. But a really nice group of still images with really cheesy music on it from a bunch of people at college somewhere in the States, I think. And then at the bottom, there's finally a BBC report. YouTube doesn't care. You know, they don't mind that the tags of BBC don't align to what we think BBC is. That doesn't matter at all. And that's the kind of issue for us in working with folksonomies. The organisation wants too much to hold on to the power of its brand, and we talked about branding earlier on, and it's got to kind of understand how we can be quite happy with this. I mean, I am. I don't have a problem with this at all. But for a lot of people in the organisation, this is really, really threatening and a really big issue. So, can a company with a stake in content successfully employ folksonomies? If this was a BBC executive asking me this, I'd say, well, you know, give me a couple of million pounds and I'll tell you. And that's kind of what we're doing. I don't admit to having a couple of million pounds, but what we're trying to do is to just try and throwing some money at some ideas, trying to do a couple of things that actually find out whether these are things that we can use and whether they are viable things for BBC services. This is a project I ran earlier on this year. There's quite a lot of people in the audience today who took part in the labs. We basically put out a rather large brief, basically saying, okay, what would we do if we were rebuilding the website from scratch now? What would it look like? How would it? What kind of interfaces and facilities would it have? We picked kind of out of 170 ideas we had submitted. We picked 29 of them. We had workshops of them in Northwest, in Yorkshire, and London. And we're developing ideas out of that now. I mean, there's ones by Limitless Innovations who are in the groups who are dealing with these tagging issue. There's also an idea from Poke and Amberlight who are here as well who are dealing with tagging as well. And quite a lot of the ideas, actually, of the 170 ideas we got, about a third of them were to do with taxonomies and about a third of them were to do with geotagging because, you know, they're the kind of things that are out there in the ether at the moment. However, of that third, nearly all of them just kind of said, geotag your content or just add tagging to your content. And that's like, okay, we know that. But what we want to know is, you know, okay, why should we do that? What is that kind of selfish motive? So what we did on the labs is really focus on users. Rather than just focusing on the technology, we got people to really think about users and really think about what users' motives might want to be to use those services. And the results we got, which we're developing at the moment, literally at the moment, are quite interesting, and we'll be trialling some of them on the site later on. The other thing we're doing, and this is what Tom Loosemore has done with Matt Bidulph and Ben Hammersley, is we've been looking at the metadata that we have. When I joined the BBC about 4 years ago, digital rights management was a really hot issue, and so we brought over Larry Lessig and we talked about what we could do with our content, and that led to the Creative Archive, which is the really painful long process of trying to release our stuff out there to let people play with it. And we've since done things like Backstage. I know Ben's around here somewhere who was the driving force behind that, where we're putting out a lot of our content and APIs around our content. And there's a whole bunch of us in the BBC that are gradually trying to just get this stuff out there because we don't kind of know what people really want to do with it. And so we're just trying to throw these things over the fence as much as we can. So this, for me, is a kind of huge package of a problem that I would drop into this landscape I've just described around taxonomies. We know that taxonomies are likely to be content agnostic, and we know that taxonomies are very likely to be driven by individual motivations. But we've also got all this kind of stuff that we don't know what people want to do with. And the problem is that huge amounts of it are unlikely to be out there as objects, watchable objects online for a while yet. Rights issues and stuff like that, which, as much as we're trying to push them forward, are moving very slowly. But what we do have is a huge amount of metadata that's created by the internal information and archives team. This was for an internal service called InFacts that reporters and producers used when they wanted to find footage from the BBC archives. And it's in a phenomenally good structured taxonomy. It's the exact opposite of that kind of taxonomy stuff I've been talking about. It's really beautifully structured data. It's absolutely, there's holes in it, but it's incredibly well done. I mean, you know, you can see there's nearly a million objects dating back 75 years. There's over 500,000, half a million subject categories, so over 500,000 individual tags, which are all comparable and which are all within a controlled vocabulary. And there's information on way over a million contributors from, for some reason here, Bruce Forsyth to Mel DeMarcos. So it's a phenomenal interface. And what Tom's managed to do with Matt and Ben is just get it out there. And with, I don't know if Ben Metcalf's here, but do we have an API on this now that we're releasing? Ben, there is an API out there in Backstage, so you can actually kind of directly build applications off the back of it. And what I think is interesting with this is the kind of best thing we've got to having the actual archive on the BBC out there to play with. So what I think we can do is basically play with this and see what kind of motivations are. At the moment, you can go into it and play with it. You can type in people's names, and you can see John Peel and all the programs he's in. We're doing some kind of relational stuff, like, you know, seeing who they often appeared with, doing a nice little spark lines thing. And, of course, what most people do when you show them this is they start using it for selfish individual reasons. So you start to look at what was on and what was happening on the day you were born. Or you even type in your name, and I have the most pathetic spark line, I think, in the whole database. I appeared on, when I used to be a curator of photography, I appeared on Yorkshire Evening News once. So that's it. Very pathetic. I'm even less famous than Mark Cantor now, apparently. But anyway. So what we want to do is kind of get this data out here and let people start throwing at it. And I'm really interested in this because I think this is where we can start to test that interface between formal and existing kind of hard taxonomies, where that kind of that relationship space between those three aspects of visibility, control, and comparability can be experimented with. I want to see services built on this that play with those tensions and create value surfaces for people that kind of exist between all of them. As I said, we're already commissioning some at the moment. But I think that actually what we need to do is find a lot more services in this area. And I think the most successful services here, they're going to be playful. They're going to be playful because they will have nothing at stake. What Flickr are fantastic at doing is building more value into their system without ruining that relationship of being playful. It's really important that interestingness isn't an overt kind of transaction on their website, because as soon as they did that, something would be at stake. People would start trying to game it in order to try and get their pictures more important in Flickr or not. The fact that interestingness is this kind of back-end thing that is a picture of the system, it's like that kind of classic Umberto Eco making a map of the landscape. You know, how do you create something which kind of visualizes a landscape without affecting what's going on in it? And that's really about preserving that playfulness of in taxonomies. And I think that's a really, really important thing. We need to make them playful, we need to make them selfish. And this is one that's really tricky for us. How do you make them content agnostic? This is a picture of my desk at work. But this is really just to kind of issue a challenge, saying that, you know, we do have money for this. I'm interested in ideas that are based around this. I'm not interested in ideas that just say, we can tag all your content. I'm interested in ideas that take that one step further. You know, why do people want to do that? What I don't kind of understand, what Flickr understood brilliantly, is just like the photo scrapbook, people have an emotional investment in photographs which makes them want to talk about them. And also there is no existing metadata around individuals' own photographs, so they add it themselves. I don't know yet what people's feelings are around telly in the same way. You know, how do people feel about, not the kind of YouTube UGC telly, but how do people feel about BBC telly? How do they want to link to it, want to index it? What kind of things do they want to say about it? What do they want to link it with? What do they want to cut it and paste it with? All of these kind of problems are things that we're facing right now in the organisation. And as a very small department within New Media, we've got some cash to throw at this. So this is a challenge. Help yourself to some of this money. It is on my desk. If you can find out where my desk is, you can come and find it and help yourself. And basically, that's about it. Thank you very much. Two things before we go to questions. This is in the tradition now, it seems to be, in Web 2.0 presentations. You find all your great stock photos on Flickr, so they're the people on it. And I almost put these next three slides in the presentation, but I thought it's probably going to go a bit wonky. But when I took this screen grab from YouTube, something caught my eye, and it kind of horrified me. And I wonder if anyone knows what it was. But it was basically the idea of having a Rodney Trotter latex mask. And I had to see what it looked like. I really had to see what it looked like. So I promised myself that I wouldn't ask anyone in the audience to put their hands up, because it feels like you've all been yo-yoing your hands up and down all day. But who wants to see the Rodney Trotter latex mask? Yes. Okay, I promise you will not sleep well tonight. There you go. Okay, that's it. That's it. Thank you very much. Of course, the only thing you're going to remember from this presentation now is the Rodney Trotter latex mask. But anyway, we're running over heavily, so do you have time for questions? Or?
Well, I was going to suggest we've got a coffee break now, and we can do questions through the break if you want,
safe,
or if you want to go and grab coffee.
Yeah.
Anyone want coffee?
Go get coffee.
Anyone got questions?
Maybe it would just come up to me, it'd be easier. It's going to be noisy here.